From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. He was the leading contender for the Democratic presidential nomination just a few weeks ago. But today, former Vermont Governor Howard Dean told supporters and the nation that he was ending his run for the White House.
I am no longer actively pursuing the presidency. We will, however, continue to build a new organization using our enormous grassroots network to continue the effort to transform the Democratic Party and to change our country.
The one-time frontrunner went winless in 17 primaries and party caucuses. Still, Howard Dean's campaign shattered Democratic fundraising records, energized thousands of under 40 voters, and lit a fire under the party faithful against the war and George W. Bush. Tonight on Point, the rise and fall of Howard Dean. Were you swept up in the fire of Howard Dean's campaign? When did the Howard Dean mystique begin to wear thin? Did it all come down to electability? And how will we remember the Howard Dean campaign? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now is Perry Bacon, reporter for Time magazine, who has been watching and writing about the Dean campaign. He was in Burlington today for Dean's announcement that he was pulling the plug on his campaign for the nomination. Hi, Perry, and welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell us, what was the atmosphere for that announcement? Surely it came as no surprise, but must have been pretty disappointing.
It was disappointing and sad. A lot of the supporters that were there, there were a lot of hugs given, a lot of hugs, not many tears. People have been expecting this for a little while. There had been, one of these told me it had been like a slow burn, especially since Iowa, and especially after New Hampshire. They sort of knew they had a great campaign, but they weren't going to win. So it wasn't, I wasn't anticipated by any means, but they were still very sad about how things went.
One of the biggest applause lines I noted came when Dean referred to the role of his wife, Judy. He said that potential first ladies didn't need to look adoringly at their husbands. They could have their own lives. And that seemed to resonate very well with that crowd.
It was a very unique thing. I had never heard him say that before. Most of the lines in the speech were a reflection of things he had said before, but it was very unique, and they seemed to like the fact that he essentially said, you know, maybe he was hoping that his campaign set out a new chart for campaign wives to be, like, stay in their jobs more and come on the campaign trail less. The problem, of course, with that is that, you know, the one moment where he had a weak time after Iowa, what he did do, he brought out his wife to go on an interview with Diane Sawyer with him. So the message there is a little in conflict, I have to say.
Of course, we could tell on television that he was surrounded by a sea of young faces, and they were certainly energized by this campaign. What were some of these young people saying about the end of the run for the presidency?
They were saying it was, you know, a lot of them were very bitter about it and sort of very sad about it. And they were saying I asked them about what they would do next. And so a few of the supporters and aides that were very young said, you know, they would look for his guidance about what to do next. If he supported some other candidate, they would consider supporting some other candidate. And they try to stay involved in politics if he specifically asked them to do that.
Did you get a sense that some of them will remain interested in politics or might they turn away?
My sense is that from talking to a lot of them both today and at some of the events is that most of them, a lot of them were driven in part to vote, you know, support Dean because he was the strongest candidate in criticizing President Bush, or he was in the beginning. He was very much anti-Bush from the very beginning. And I think that those supporters are definitely going to vote for whoever comes out of the Democratic race. My sense is a lot of them are going to be reluctant to do a lot of things they did for Dean, like go to these posts on the blogs and go to these meetups and donate money like they did for them. That may not happen if another candidate emerges who these young people aren't supportive of.
Perry, give us a sense of what it felt like from your perspective as a reporter covering the campaign when he went from being front runner to just the sort of waning days of how this campaign has played out.
The waning days were interesting. I mean, it was still, interestingly, I mean, a lot of times when you see a candidate begin to lose momentum, he also loses reporters. But for us, for the reporters, the story was so interesting. Having seen the rise, it was very interesting to also watch the fall, and you could tell the crowds were still pretty good. Dean always had a very fervent support group. It was just, it was interesting that sort of the energy from the campaign aides, you could sort of tell the end was near, and even the reporters had a sense that, you know, there was some sense before of like a lot of stress. You're covering a front runner, and then you weren't covering a front runner. It was like watching a play end on some level.
Do you have a favorite moment from the campaign, something that, sort of epitomizes the Howard Dean campaign for president?
There was that moment in August where they had those rallies, and I remember one of them. They had something called the Sleepless Summer Tour, was sort of Dean showing how big his movement was. He had people in Portland and Seattle, and I personally went to a rally in New York where there were 10,000 people there and all kinds of reporters. It was a very interesting moment, sort of seeing how he came up and how strong he had become. And there was an interesting moment last night that was sort of showed you how he had come down from that. He started talking about, he was a very, very post-mortem speech last night saying, "We've changed the party. We've had a speech in the Milwaukee, Madison, Wisconsin, I'm referring to." It was very, coming from like seeing him at the top where he was talking about changing politics completely. He had already sort of said, "We have changed." It became very post-mortem. It was very interesting to see the contrast.
Well, Perry, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck getting out of Burlington. I understand there's some bad weather up there.
Thank you. All right.
Thanks, Perry. Let me turn now to Steve Grossman, who is joining us from Watertown, Massachusetts. He's former chair of the Howard Dean campaign and also former chair of the Democratic National Committee. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks for having me, Gail.
So this must be a very interesting day for you as well. Let's roll back the tape a little bit, and I'd be interested in knowing what first attracted you to Dean.
Well, I've known Howard since 1992, got to know him quite well when we traveled together when I was chairman of the Democratic National Committee and he was working to help elect Democratic governors. But the moment when I knew that I would support him for the presidency was 2000, when up in Vermont, the civil unions battle occurred, and a lot of people said to Howard Dean, "Howard, stay away from this. This is a loser. You could lose your office over this." And Howard said, "If I don't stand up for the principle of equal rights for every single person, then I've wasted my whole career." And I saw that as a moment of courage. I haven't seen in 35 years in politics too many politicians put their office on the line for principle. And I said, that's a guy that I might very well support for president. And when he came to see me in the summer of 2002, having helped me in my race for governor, I should say parenthetically, that moment of courage stuck with me. And he showed that courage at other moments during this campaign, standing up against the president, the war, No Child Left Behind, a variety of other things. In many ways, Howard Dean defined the debate in the Democratic Party over the last year. He gave this party its backbone, and he made it acceptable to criticize the president appropriately for things the president was doing that were not in the best interests, in his judgment, of this country.
He began his campaign, Steve, as you know, talking a great deal about fiscal responsibility, and then became much more of the, well, I'm not sure if radical is quite the right word, but much more of a strident anti-war campaigner. And I'm wondering if, in retrospect, you think maybe he should have stuck with the first message.
Well, he did talk about fiscal discipline and accountability because that's what he did in Vermont, raising the bond rating, paying off debt, and doing a lot of things by still being fiscally responsible. What I actually found most striking about the campaign is the failure to use the unique personal story that Howard Dean has to tell as much as he should have. I mean, John Edwards uses his personal story. John Kerry always refers to his Vietnam experience. Dick Gephardt always referred to his background, his parents, his father, how he grew up. Howard Dean, long before he was a politician, long before he was a governor, was a doctor, was a caregiver, was in family practice with his wife, Judy. And I don't think we ever fully saw into his heart and to his life what that experience meant, what he understood about families, what he understood about seniors, women, men, cutting their pills in half and having to choose between their meds and their rent and their food and their clothing, and what he did about it when he was governor because of that unique experience. And I think it would have humanized him to a far greater extent than he was able to do when so much of the message was about the war and standing up with backbone against the president. And I think that more personal quality to him never really was quite adequately developed. And, you know, you invite a president into your home every night for 4 years or 8 years. That's kind of a unique office in American life where people really develop a relationship with the president. I'm not sure people ever really developed a relationship with Howard Dean, the doctor, the caregiver, the man who understood that the most precious gift we all have is the gift of good health.
Hmm. Well, and it does make you wonder, Steve, how could Dean go from being the fresh new face and voice with $45 million in mostly small donations to what happened today?
Well, you know, that's a long conversation. Let me telescope it a little bit. When he had the message and the money and the motivated workers and was riding high in December, you know, a series of things began to happen that I think began to eat away at the momentum. He got into this very negative, vitriolic, almost death struggle with Dick Gephardt. It became very harsh, and the voters of Iowa on caucus night clearly said, we don't like that. We're going to reward the people who are giving us a positive vision of where you're going to take our families and about quality of life. And they penalized Dick Gephardt, who finished fourth, neighbor from the neighboring state, practically the hometown guy, and Howard Dean, and they gave the nod that night to John Kerry and to John Edwards. So that did him no good. It violated a basic principle in politics that when A attacks B or B attacks A, they both go down, and a third or fourth candidate benefit from that experience. Number two, there was a moment there when Howard's tape from 4 years ago that he did an interview with a Canadian radio station or TV station, and he said in that course of that debate that caucuses are in general in the hands of extremists and special interests.
Bet he wished he could have taken that one back.
Well, probably, but the question then becomes, why didn't the campaign know about that tape well in advance, and why, knowing that it could be so damaging in December, why didn't he go out there 6 months earlier and say to the people of Iowa, look, I've been to all 99 counties, you've taught me a humbling lesson. This process of participatory politics is incredible. It's an amazing journey. And I said some things 4 years ago, and I got to tell you, folks, I apologize for them because I didn't know what I was talking about. Get rid of it. Get it behind you.
Well, do you think he'd forgotten he had said it?
Well, whether he forgot he said it, you know, it's important to research everything about yourself in a political campaign that might be a problem and then figure out how to deal with it. I mean, that's a common thing that people do for any race, state representative all the way up to president. And that it didn't happen that way and was so devastating, I'm told that his polling numbers dropped by more than 10 points overnight. And even Tom Harkin, the senator from Iowa, coming on board to endorse him, didn't ever help him get his momentum back. And then, of course, that was that moment in a town meeting when a guy got up and talked about Bush and neighborliness and then got up a second time, and Howard, in a rather brusque way, basically said, you know, sit down, mister. I've heard you. You've had your say. Now it's time my turn to talk. And, you know, there's a quality of bluntness and directness and authenticity to Howard Dean that was very fresh and that people really loved. I mean, it was really refreshing to see somebody give a direct answer, not give you multiple answers to the same question, not speak out of both sides of your mouth. Tom Harkin reflected on that when he endorsed him. But sometimes there's a law of unintended consequences, and you wind up being so direct, so blunt, and it comes across as shoot from the hip and sometimes can get you into serious trouble. And it did get him into trouble when everybody was watching in the run-up to the Iowa caucuses. And it culminated, I think, in that moment, the night of the Iowa caucuses, in that speech he gave when, shall we say, it dominated news for the next 4 or 5 days, and there was no way he could ever recover in New Hampshire. And once he lost Iowa and New Hampshire and there was no gas left in the gas tank, the car was running on empty.
Well, we're going to continue our conversation about that and many more aspects of his story. We're talking tonight about Howard Dean's exit from the race. Did Howard Dean act as the rabbit for the Democrats? Why, when voters took a longer look, was he a less attractive candidate? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking about Howard Dean's meteoric rise and rapid fall in the Democratic campaign for the White House. Did you meet up with Howard Dean on the issues, on war in Iraq, on education and health care reform? Will you mourn the loss of candidate Dean? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Before much of the country had even heard of Howard Dean, the former Vermont governor appeared on this program on July 3, 2002, well before the Iraq War became a defining issue for him. Back then, Dean promoted himself as a fiscal conservative who, as governor, extended health care coverage to almost all of Vermont's children.
Republicans embraced the issue, embraced the notion of borrow and spend. This is my big problem with Governor with President Bush. With his budget. We go back to the borrow and spend politics that have been shown by many Republicans, but particularly this president, as well as President Reagan, and it leads to enormous deficits. You don't have to do that. It's not necessary to do it, and it's no better than tax and spend liberal Democrats. In fact, it's worse because at least the liberal Democrats are balancing the budget. The Republicans don't balance budgets. They can't pay their bills, and it's time that we had it. I believe the party of fiscal responsibility, which is the Democrats, not the Republicans, in charge of the White House.
Well, that somber Dean from the summer of 2002 was a major contrast to the red-faced, angry Dean who energized supporters with his fierce opposition to the Iraq War. Here's Howard Dean during a campaign stop in Seattle in August of 2003.
As the commander-in-chief of the United States military, I will never hesitate to send our troops to any country in the world to defend the United States of America. But as the commander-in-chief of the United States military, I will never send our sons and our daughters and our brothers and sisters to a foreign country to die without telling the truth about why they're going there.
And we're continuing our conversation this evening with Steve Grossman, former chair of the Howard Dean campaign. And joining me now in the studio is Sarah Schweitzer, who is a reporter for the Boston Globe. She covered the Dean campaign from July of last year until the end of January. So welcome, Sarah. You certainly saw some contrasts along the way, didn't you?
Yeah, there were some changes along the way.
Was there a moment when you were perhaps at a campaign stop somewhere or somewhere else along the way when you thought to yourself, this guy really could go all the way?
Well, I think there were some times over the summer when he would go to house parties in Iowa that would be somewhat small affairs, but you could see him connecting with voters and you could see him actually surprising them somewhat with some of what he was saying, his opposition to the war and to the president's tax cuts. And I think they were hearing a message that they hadn't heard and that surprised them to some degree.
And do you think that's what was resonating with them, the apparent candor of someone who was, as you say, telling them something they hadn't heard before?
I think that was part of it. I think that he was a candidate who was speaking very clearly about two issues that were bubbling and certainly ones that there was room to disagree with the president on. And Howard Dean did it in a way that was clearest and most bright line of all the candidates at that point and caught the attention of people that way.
Do you think people were a little misled, though, in terms of looking at this campaign, of the difference between voters who are shopping for a candidate versus being ready to buy one, in essence?
Yeah, I think that's actually a really good point. And there were all those bumper stickers in New Hampshire that said dated Dean and married Carrie. I think that, and especially after talking to voters in New Hampshire and in Iowa, when actually the time came, I heard a lot of people saying that I was intrigued by Dean. I was absolutely taken by what he was saying. But as the time came to actually cast my ballot, I looked around again and found another candidate, be it Kerry or Edwards or whoever else. And I think that certainly there were other issues that came up along the way with Governor Dean that I think gave people pause as well.
Steve Grossman was telling us a moment ago about the negativity of the Dean-Gephardt struggle. Did you see that playing out in the same way of just really torpedoing Dean's attractiveness as a candidate?
Yeah, and I thought that was a very good point. And I would even go back a little bit further, maybe, and I would go back to the Gore endorsement. When former Vice President Al Gore endorsed him, it was in early December, and just a week later, Saddam Hussein was discovered. And it took a lot of air out of what Governor Dean was saying. And there was a press conference that was held in Manchester when he gave a major domestic policy speech, and there was not a single question asked about domestic policy. The entire press corps, there were maybe 30 people, maybe 40, and it was a very angry sort of press conference. And it was, and his people, Governor Dean's people, were taken aback. Governor Dean was taken aback by the sort of the tenor of the questions, and there was an intensity to it. And I think that was when it struck him that he truly was in the position of being perhaps a front runner, and that this was going to be the level of questioning, and that it was coming at a time when he had to answer questions about a topic that he wasn't in the best position to answer at that point.
Steve Grossman, I want to bring you back into the conversation. How did that feel from your position on the other side of the barricades?
In terms of that particular moment?
Yes.
Well, I think the Saddam Hussein matter played out in a different way also, as Sarah recalls. Howard, who didn't have a lot of foreign policy experience, needed to find a moment to lay out a comprehensive vision for the role of America in a tough world. And he needed to lay out a robust, muscular American foreign policy based on, as he put it, American values. And he sort of gave that speech in Los Angeles, but he insisted in inserting into that speech the famous line, "We're no safer, even though Saddam Hussein has been captured." I may be paraphrasing. And it trumped the whole message of the speech. And even though it probably is true that we're no safer as a country, whether Saddam Hussein was captured or not, it displayed something of a political tin ear as to what people were thinking in the country. And I think people were taken aback by that. And then when he said something about Osama bin Laden deserving a full jury trial later on, and people thought about that and said, wait a second, this is a war criminal. This is a guy who's committed crimes against humanity and against the American people and bragged about it. He should be taken off like the Nazi war criminals did, or like Adolf Eichmann did, have a military tribunal and be executed summarily. It struck a discordant note that he just was not quite in tune with people's values and priorities. I don't know whether Sarah would agree with that.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. I think that he made that comment, and I think it raised a lot of questions in people's minds, people who maybe didn't agree with the war but said, let's at least agree that the world is a better place without Saddam Hussein. And if Governor Dean was going to be out of step on that, and he also didn't have this, as you said, the vast foreign policy experience, it called into question in some people's minds, where does this guy really stand? It's a question that got raised in their minds, and you don't want that if you're running for office.
And Steve, you're saying that this was Dean insisting that be in there, which tells me that you and perhaps some other people were cringing at that thought.
Well, I think the foreign policy team said, Governor, you've got to lay out this vision and put down a marker and have a foundation that your administration will be built on from a foreign policy standpoint, and put to bed once and for all, or put to rest once and for all, any questions that you have a commitment to a strong, muscular, robust foreign policy, and that you wouldn't hesitate to use American power when appropriate. That line, it trumped almost everything else that he said, and he never got the benefit out of that speech. And remember, that's December, and this happened just around the time that the negative campaign was building up in Iowa, and it happened just around the time when the revelation of that tape about caucuses and extremists and that I referred to earlier. And it was kind of a confluence of problems and mistakes that undermined the momentum. And once you lose momentum, whether it's sports or politics, it's awful hard to get it back. And the campaign never really got it back. And then when you get to the last 2 weeks, that's the moment of truth when you make the sale, because a lot of people are expressing preferences, but I think Sarah would agree, a lot of those people were just undecided. They liked Gebhardt. They liked Edwards. They liked Kerry. This is a distinguished group of men who are running, and men and women who are running for office. And just when you're ready to make that sale, you know, the problems kind of caused enough doubt, and then you layer that negative quality to the campaign over it, and he wound up finishing a disappointing third, and then the night of the Iowa caucuses, of course, and the rest is sort of history.
Sarah, I don't know if you want to have a quick response to that, and then we want to hear from some of our listeners.
Yeah, I think the point that people really began to doubt their feelings about Governor Dean, I think, is a sort of a poignant one, that they were sort of intrigued by a phenom, but they were also scared of voting for a phenom. And I think that therein was part of his problem, that he almost had become too big, too fast, and people thought he must be too good to be true.
All right. Well, let's hear from Robert, who's on the line from Chicago, Illinois. Welcome to the program, Robert.
Thanks for taking my call. First of all, I'd like to start out by saying that the Dean supporters early were generally quite young, very liberal. I would venture to say that a lot of them were NPR listeners. And I think that NPR's coverage and not just the mainstream media, but also the liberal media's coverage of Howard Dean was actually part of the problem in his loss of support.
In what way, Robert?
From very early on, I detected a negative viewpoint of NPR pundits, news analysts, and even just the announcers on NPR were just criticizing him and just basically spinning his coverage in a negative light. They would constantly make comments about his anger management issues, for example, or they'd make vague references to various mistakes that he may have made without really giving any specifics.
Okay, Robert, appreciate the point. Sarah, you're not here to speak for NPR, obviously, but let me ask you about the larger question, because this has been raised elsewhere about media scrutiny, that perhaps Howard Dean was being held to a higher standard than the other candidates.
I think it's hard to sort of judge at this point. I mean, it's a little bit too close to it. But at the same time, Governor Dean raised more money than any other Democrat. He had a phenomenal following, and he draw crowds in the thousands. And certainly, everybody in the media began to pay attention to him. And he was showered with praise, and he was elevated in part because of the media. And at the same time, when the time came for people to take a hard look at him, the media did as well. And I think the scrutiny was intense, absolutely. I think some of the stories that came out about his record in Vermont were very very closely looked at by report. You know, the stuff that people were looking at was very closely looked at and poured through. And it might have seemed small because he was from a state that was small, but at the same time, that was his record. And meanwhile, he had sealed nearly half of his gubernatorial papers for a span of 10 years following his departure from office, meaning that there wasn't everything to look at. And it invited questions as to why he had sealed that stuff. And I think that in and of itself raised questions among reporters and probably the public as well.
Steve, I'd be interested in hearing your take on that as well. You can sort of live by the media and die by the media. Is that what happened here?
You want to be the 44th president of the United States. I think you have to take it all and deal with it. And, you know, at the end of the day, the media's got a job to do. And, you know, I've never found in my political life, whether as a candidate or as a sort of party leader, that the press often printed things that I didn't say. The media doesn't make it up. They may color it, they may tone it in certain fashion, but I think, you know, this is a winnowing process, and I think the winnowing process is a really good one, and people can complain about Iowa and caucuses and New Hampshire and how come it's not regional primaries, but you go through that gauntlet for a period of time. It does shake out and does expose strengths and weaknesses in a way that are sometimes quite surprising. But I don't, at the end of the day, even though I'm sad and feel badly that it didn't go further and feel that the movement that Howard created is really a legacy that he can build on, as he said today, I honestly don't want to criticize the media because I just don't feel that the media's job is to be tough on candidates. It really is.
All right. Well, let's hear from another media person. Matt Bai is joining us now from Washington. He's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, has been covering the presidential election for the magazine, and is also author of the Dean Legacy article in today's New York Times. Welcome, Matt.
Hi, Gail. And that's actually on the Times website, I should point out, so it's not so people don't go rifling through their newspaper.
Okay. Thanks for saving us that trouble. You had an interesting comparison today that there was someone else, not Jimmy Carter, not Bill Clinton, who is the applicable Democrat to be compared with Dean. Who is that, and why so?
Well, first, let me thank Steve Grossman for a very sane answer and not rising to the easy bait there against the media, which happens all too often. My point today was actually about Bob La Follette, who was actually a Republican, a progressive Republican from Wisconsin. And Howard Dean had taken to invoking La Follette's name in the closing weeks during the Wisconsin primary because La Follette is known as someone who left this great reformist legacy. And the point I was making today on the website and got a lot of people in Dean Nation a little upset as well is simply that it's fine to talk about Howard Dean as someone who contributed to the party in this year's campaign. It's fine to talk about him moving the party toward a more confrontational stance, or showing how you can raise money on the internet, or invigorating legions of young voters. But I don't think it's fair to compare him to a real reformer or someone who built a legacy that will last a long time in terms of creating a new vision for the country. I think that was really the failure of his campaign, was the failure to articulate or to imagine some kind of bold new agenda that would have energized his campaign, and in any event, win or lose, would have lived on beyond it.
Do you think in some way the Al Gore endorsement came at just the wrong time for him in terms of laying out that kind of agenda? You know, he seemed to suddenly become the party of mainstream or the candidate of the mainstream Democrats rather than being out there as this interesting, fresh new voice.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would I've heard that argument. I think it would hold more water if his activist base had started to desert him at that point. There are so many explanations that have been offered, and I really think, as is often the case in politics and in life, that the answers here are more basic than they seem. That on one hand, voters simply don't pay attention to elections until a few weeks out, no matter how much we in the media talk about it. The fact is, voters didn't take a good, hard look at Howard Dean until a few weeks before the Iowa caucus, when they really stopped and said, okay, who is this guy? And then I think Dean, at the core of his campaign, as I say, was lacking a grander, more constructive vision. You know, we sometimes mock the slogans that candidates use, but they mean something. John Kerry's the real deal, which basically says, hey, I'm a guy who can get elected. And John Edwards talks about the two Americas, which is a code for a much more powerful vision. Dean's thing was, we're taking the country back. And what that really meant was, we're going to beat the other guys. They shouldn't be governing. We should. And I think at the end of the day, that was not a compelling vision beyond its initial success. It needed to grow into something more, and it didn't.
And so your take would be, this really does come down to electability.
Well, sure. There's a huge emphasis on electability within the party right now. But I think it also comes down to some sense of a vision of what you're offering people as an alternative. And I think while the sort of resentment that Dean tapped into, and particularly focused around the war early on in the campaign, were very, very effective, he was still running the same ads, you know, right up to the Iowa caucus. I was against the war. They all voted for it. And the polls and focus groups would tell you that voters had simply moved on from that question. The voters were looking at a more nuanced set of policy questions, a more nuanced idea of where these candidates were at and what they offered. And I don't think the Dean campaign ever really got a grasp, perhaps because it took off so quickly, on what those distinctions were and what was going to create a real vision for the campaign.
All right. Well, Matt, thank you so much.
Anytime. Thanks, Gil.
We're talking tonight about former Vermont Governor Howard Dean's bid for the presidency, now over. He said today he began as an asterisk in the polls. Will he end up as an asterisk in campaign history? What will Howard Dean's campaign be studied for? His seemingly unstoppable ascent, opposing the war in Iraq, or something else? I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about Howard Dean, who pulled the plug on his campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination today. Was the Howard Dean phenomenon a media creation? Media target? Maybe both. Did Howard Dean bring the Democratic wing back to the Democratic Party? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking with Steve Grossman, former chair of the Howard Dean campaign, and Sarah Schweitzer, Boston Globe reporter, who followed and wrote about the Howard Dean campaign. And joining us now from Oberlin, Ohio, is Charlie Sohn, a confirmed Deaniac. Charlie's a freshman in politics and film major at Oberlin College, and a member of the Oberlin Democrats, spent January of this year in New Hampshire with the Dean campaign. Welcome, Charlie, and I guess this was not an easy day for you either.
Well, no, it wasn't. But I was very pleased with Dean's concession speech and the fact that he's going to be turning the campaign into an organization that fights for real change in this country.
Are you frustrated by his withdrawal from the race, or did you see it as inevitable?
I didn't see it as inevitable. I'm not frustrated by him dropping out, though. I think that he showed a lot of class. Personally, I'm actually still going to be voting for Howard Dean. His name remains on the ballot. to try and get as many progressive delegates to the caucus to the convention as possible. But you know, I definitely I'm a little you know, disappointed right now.
Hmm. Charlie, what about him inspired you to go out and work for him? I assume you were probably out there in the cold if you were in New Hampshire, or what, knocking on doors and
yeah, phone banking, doing everything of that sort. I think I was attracted to Dean mainly for three reasons. I mean, first of all, like most Democrats, my main goal this election would be to beat Bush. And I think that's really important. And I think that Dean's campaign highlighted a strategy that I think it's been a myth among Democrats for the past 10 years that the way to win elections is by getting swing voters with wedge issues and by hugging the center. And I think that, you know, the Republicans have known that the way to get the center is to create an exciting campaign with a clear message. And, I mean, this is why you hear so much about Reagan Democrats. I mean, Reagan wasn't centrist on any issue. So Dean's electability actually was the first thing that drew me to him. I think that specifically on the issue of health care, it's been an issue that Democrats have been afraid to talk about since, you know, Clinton's plan blew up in 93. But I think that, you know, and this election, people started talking about it again, but, you know, Dean's the only person who's accomplished health care in the race, and he brought health care to Vermont citizens. And so that really, you know, touched me. And then finally, and this is where I majorly disagree with Matt Bai, who was on earlier, I think that Dean's campaign definitely did change the face of American politics. I think that one thing that Matt Bai missed about Dean's slogan is it wasn't take this country back. It was you have the power to take this country back. And it's, you know, it seems like a small difference rhetorically. But the way the campaign was run was to sort of bring people back into politics and bring people back into civic participation in a way that, you know, they haven't been doing. And by holding house meetings and having people in the community involved in the campaign, I think that we really brought politics to a place where, you know, civic participation wasn't about watching CNN for half an hour every day and then going and voting.
All right, Charlie. Well, I would say the Dean campaign certainly had a good worker in you, so thank you so much.
Anytime.
Let's go to our phone lines now. Eli is on the line from Madison, Wisconsin. Hello, Eli, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, Gail. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say, as a Dean supporter, and I also wanted to ask your guests what they thought about this, is that I always felt like this was more of a movement than a campaign, in the sense of getting, just like Charlie was saying, empowering people and bringing them back into politics. And just, you know, I felt like it was more about the other Dean supporters and connecting with people who wanted to stand up to the Republicans and didn't feel like there was any voice for us in the Democratic Party anymore.
So do you see that as his legacy, Eli?
Yeah, because we're not going away. I mean, like, I was never interested in politics before, and, you know, once I got a taste of the game, I loved it, and I want to keep playing, you know, and I've even given thought to, you know, going into politics myself. And, I mean, I just think that, that you know, there's a difference between a movement and a campaign, and that movements take a long time to translate into electoral success. And with all due respect to Mr. Grossman, I don't think that it was a very good, I don't think it was a very well-run campaign. I don't think that Dean was a particularly great candidate. You know, he wasn't polished or coached very well, certainly. But the movement will live on long beyond his candidacy.
All right. And, well, I tell you what, Eli, I appreciate your point, and I do want to throw that one to Steve Grossman. You may or may not want to respond to how well the campaign was run, but it must be music to your ears when somebody like Eli says he's energized by this notion and he's going to get involved now.
Well, see, I agree with him, and I disagree with Matt also. I think this campaign has changed presidential politics perhaps forever. I mean, you know, a lot of people talk about campaign finance reform. This was legitimate campaign finance reform because it was primarily financed by small contributions, and those small contributions empowered people and made them feel like stakeholders in democracy. And by creating a movement that re-energizes participatory politics, if Howard Dean follows through with what he promised to do today in Burlington, not only to support the Democratic nominee, because we're united, as we haven't been in a long time, in a desire to beat Bush, but also to use this grassroots organization to change the face of politics, we're going to need to bring 3 to 5 million voters out to the polls, new ones, in order to defeat Bush. And any nominee, whether it's John Kerry or John Edwards, I hope will show the appropriate respect and admiration and humility for what Howard Dean was able to accomplish. But that, those 400,000 donors who contributed almost $50 million, that is a powerful force, because it's not just about the money. It's about feeling like they have a stake in democracy, and we haven't seen a candidate come along in a long time who could wipe away the cynicism, the apathy, and the complacency and make it fun and exciting and meaningful to participate again.
Well, actually, we have a couple of excerpts from what Dean had to say today. One of them was to that point that he had led the Democratic Party back to its heart and soul. Let's listen to that.
This has been a campaign that has been extraordinarily different. The new approach, planting seeds on the internet, strengthening grassroots, face-to-face, obtaining support from hundreds of thousands of small donors. All these steps can revitalize our democracy and return power to ordinary Americans.
And Steve, I know you're very familiar with his line about how he represented the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, which actually came from the late Senator Paul Wellstone of Minnesota.
Absolutely. Well, look, I think that the people who have spoken eloquently, whether you're a college student or you happen to be a nurse or a computer programmer or somebody who hasn't voted in 12 years because you don't think it mattered, those people want leadership. And if Howard keeps them together, keeps them unified, provides some leadership, involves them in decisions to support Democratic candidates not only for president but all the way up and down the line, that to me can be a powerful tool for revitalizing democracy, and I think that's what Howard intends to do, and I was very proud of him today, and I thought he struck just the right tone.
We have another excerpt from that speech, Steve, that I wanted to let you and everyone else listen to, and that was when he was speaking to the future as to what his plans were.
I will support the nominee of our party. I will do everything I can to beat George W. Bush. I urge you to do the same, but we will not be above in this organization of letting our nominee know that we expect them to adhere to the standards that this organization has set for decency, honesty, integrity, and standing up for ordinary American working people.
Now, Steve, I'm wondering your perspective on this. Did Dean miss an opportunity to be even more gracious here and perhaps turn over his delegates to either Kerry or John Edwards? Or?
No, I think that it's going to take a while to sort this out. It's been an emotional roller coaster ride, not only for Howard Dean, but for all of his supporters. Some have been saddened, some have been devastated by it, but I think that was an optimistic statement about the future. But it was also a challenge. He was also saying, look, we're going to hold the nominee to high standards as the price of our involvement, and that's not defiant. It simply says, hey, we articulated some values and some priorities in this campaign, and while we didn't win, we created something of true lasting value, and if you want us involved in your campaign, and we will be involved to help defeat George Bush, stand up for principles and values that are uniquely American values. Howard doesn't claim any unique ownership of those values, but I think he was a great spokesperson for a vast number of people who felt simply dealt out of the political process. Young people, lapsed voters, people of color, all kinds of people who simply said, oh my goodness, this is a chance where I can really make a difference. Everybody wants to make a difference. Howard gave them an opportunity to do that. That is powerful.
Let's go to Nahant, Massachusetts now. We want to hear from Paul, who's on the line. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks. I want to ask a couple of questions. Just a short preamble. It seemed to me like the Democratic Party in the early 90s adopted the Lincoln bedroom strategy of going after large donors. Maybe that was in response to a drop in the contributions that have been made by waning numbers of union members, or maybe there were other reasons. But it was a conscious decision made. I wonder if your guests think that there really has been a change now in the potential to financially support a Democratic candidate by looking at small donors, and whether the Democratic Leadership Council, which embodied the Lincoln bedroom strategy, is going to change its stripes, and the party is going to move to more grassroots support and in a slightly leftward direction.
All right. Thank you, Paul.
I have one more question.
Quickly.
Okay. And that is, whether your guests think that there were real structural problems either with the candidate or with the candidate's support, so that even though Howard Dean rose rapidly and generated a tremendous amount of enthusiasm, that it really was something that was not at this time going to happen.
Well, I suspect that's something we're going to be reading about for days and days and days, Paul. Maybe we can just ask Steve Grossman to speak to the money question, because, Steve, that's certainly something that you saw when you were chair of the DNC.
Well, I think the campaign finance reform bills of Marty Meehan and Chris Shays in the House and McCain-Feingold certainly basically were a shot across the bow of the Democratic Party, both parties, particularly the Democratic Party, because ironically the Republican Party has done a great job raising money from small donors for years and has built an infrastructure to do it. Democratic Party leveled the playing field by raising vast amounts of money from wealthy individuals, labor unions, and corporations. And I think that perverted the political process. And I will say that as somebody who participated in it and led a Democratic Party and raised a lot of the money from those people. But by raising the money from those wealthy sources, you say to people who are small donors and ordinary citizens, hey, you know something? I can't make a difference. I can't an impact. The system is bought and paid for by people whom I perceived as special interests. So by creating campaign finance reform and then by running a campaign, as Howard did, that was based primarily on the involvement of small donors for whom $50 was a big deal and it was valued by Howard Dean, I think it changed the face of political fundraising forever. And if the Democratic Party is going to survive and grow, it better listen to and visit with the model of Howard Dean and learn from that, because that is the future of the Democratic Party in exactly the way Howard Dean did it.
Sarah, I want to hear from you one more time. I'm wondering if you have a favorite moment from the campaign.
A favorite moment? Well, actually, one that was sort of crystallizing in my mind anyway was a house party in Waterloo, Iowa in June, which would have been pretty early on with Howard Dean's visits out there. And he was at this house party, and he had given his speech, and he was looking a bit overheated. It was a hot day, and he was wearing gray flannel pants, and his shirt was rolled up, and he just looked a bit flustered. And John Kerry walked in, and he was wearing a very pressed blue chambray shirt, and he just looked very put together, and all eyes turned to John Kerry. And it was sort of a moment where you could tell that Howard Dean had to forfeit the audience, and it seems as though it's almost come full circle.
Well, thank you all. We have heard from many people this hour. Sarah, first of all, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And Steve Grossman, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We heard earlier from Perry Bacon, reporter from Time Magazine, and from Matt Bai, who joined us from Washington, contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. Also to Charlie Sohn, who joined us from Oberlin, Ohio, a politics and film major at Oberlin College. You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.